Have you ever wanted something, but you were so afraid of failing at it that you never even tried? What if there were a way to guarantee you never failed? Is there something you're thinking about right now that you'd go try? Welcome to I Am This Age, the podcast proving you're never too old. It's never too late, so go do that thing you're always talking about. I'm Molly Sider, a certified professional life coach, storyteller, and real life changemaker in my 40s. My guest today is a former musician and music producer from New York City who worked with loads of famous musicians only to give that all up to become a novelist in his 70s. He has had a long list of impressive accomplishments, which I'll get to a little later. But the important part is that he has been willing to take risks and try new things throughout his life, manifesting success in almost everything he set out to do. And he's here today to talk us through how he does it. He's one of those people you want to just keep around all the time because he has a way of making you feel like nothing is really that big of a deal and everything is going to be okay. Before we get started, a quick request. If you're enjoying these episodes, please take a minute before you move on with your day to share your favorite one with a friend you think might also enjoy it. It's the easiest way for us to grow. And the more we grow, the more we can help you grow. Please also make sure you're subscribed and don't forget to rate and review. It's a fast and easy way to support us. Okay, without further ado, please enjoy the extraordinary Rick Blyweiss.
Hi, I'm Rick Blyweiss. I am 78 years old, about to be 79 very soon. I've been a record producer. I've been a music industry executive. I've been an educator, a speaker. When I was in my 60s, I switched industries and became a publishing executive. And most recently, I have become an award-winning author. And so that, and I've done a lot of other things in between because I believe life is an adventure and you're never too old to chase your rainbows.
Yes. Man. What a great introduction. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
That we can awesome. End it right there.
Yeah, I know. We can go now.
Thanks for coming, Rick.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. David Ben-Perrott is here, obviously. You can hear cool. him.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, a quick little bit about Rick's long and multifaceted career, because it is quite impressive. As I mentioned, he started in the music industry in New York City as a musician, a producer, a music marketer, and a music executive. He wrote about music for newspapers and magazines. He worked with tons of huge artists like Melissa Etheridge, Kiss, U2, Whitney Houston, Britney Spears, and loads more. And he's been nominated for multiple Grammy Awards. And after all that, at age 58, Rick decided to retire from the music industry and from New York City living and move with his wife to Ashland, Oregon, in the middle of nowhere. Why, you ask?
My wife was also in the music industry in New York. She was an executive in record companies as well. And we both looked at the music industry of the early 2000s and late 1990s and realized it wasn't the same industry either of us had been in the majority of our careers. Big corporations had bought up all the record companies, so they were no longer kind of freewheeling and flexible, and instead they were bound by corporate rules and regulations. Then you had Napster come in with all the freeloading, and it changed the entire dynamic of music sales and marketing. And it just wasn't the same industry anymore. We weren't getting the same pleasure out of it. So we both decided to retire. My wife retired, I think, a year before me. And so here we are, we're in New York. I basically, other than 3 years in Miami in my early college days, had lived in New York my entire life, New York City. My wife had lived there for the last 35 years of her life. And so one day she just kind of looked at me and said, well, we could live anywhere we want. Where should we live? And we decided, because of family, we'd stay in the U.S. We knew we didn't want to be in a big city because, Christ, we were in New York. That's the best big city in the world, in my opinion. So why leave?
Right.
And we're in a Barnes & Noble one day, and we're looking in the magazine section, and there's a magazine, I think it was called Retirement Now or something like that. And on the cover is a picture of this town called Ashland, Oregon. And it says, the best small town in America. And so we look at each, we read the article, and it's got the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. It's got the Oregon, the Ashland Independent Film Festival. It's the home to Southern Oregon University. It's the home to 40 art galleries, 100 restaurants, mm-hmm. for a town of 20,000 people, literally in the middle of nowhere. A 5-hour drive from Portland and a 6-hour drive from San Francisco with nothing in between, you know, any large consequence. We had never heard of it. So we said, what the heck? Let's visit it. So we came to Ashland. We fell in love with it. And here we are.
Do you have kids, by the way?
Yes, I have two grown sons, and they're probably older than you.
I don't know about that. Well, I don't know either. I'm 45.
Well, they're right in there. Let's see. My oldest son was born in 75, and my youngest in 80. So they're
okay. I'm right in between them.
You're right in between them.
You and your wife were heading out to Oregon. You had never been there before. You found it from a magazine, which is amazing.
That's unbelievable.
The best little city moving from the best big city.
That's such a 90s story right there. You know, people are like, what's a magazine now?
Yeah, seriously. It really is. Were you scared at all to move across the country, to leave New York?
Oh, not at all. No. First of all, my entire life, new adventures have never scared me. They've just always been, to me, exciting opportunities. And I mean that sincerely, not just lip service there. But no, we were just kind of ready. You know, life's an adventure. And so that was just another part of it. No fear at all.
And did you have a plan for what you do once you got there? Or were you just going to wing it?
Oh, no. The plan was we were both retiring. And we did retire. And my wife pretty much stayed retired. Her name's Deborah. I got really bored with retirement. I am a type A. In fact, a friend of mine, many, 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 many years, is a psychologist, and he does biofeedback. And many years ago, he did biofeedback on me and found that I was more relaxed when I was problem solving than when I was trying to relax.
Interesting.
And so that's me. So I got really bored. So I joined the board of directors of the Shakespeare Festival, of the Film Festival. I helped the food bank get their building. I joined the president's board of the university. And I still found that I wasn't really using all the knowledge that I had built up over my career as an executive and whatever. And fortunately, I was introduced to Blackstone and started to go to work for them. But no, the plan was full retirement.
You said that you went to work for Blackstone, but did you begin writing before you met him?
Well, yeah, actually, the way it kind of happened was when we moved to Ashland, in the house that we were living in, I became friends with my next door neighbor, and she was a poet. And she found out from me that over the course of my life, I had written, as you said, magazine and newspaper articles and things like that. And she said, I'm in a writing group. Why? Maybe you'd like to join the group. We've got memoirists, we've got fictional novelists, we've got poets, we've got all sorts of writers. I think they'd like you, you'd like them, and maybe it'll stir your creative juices. And so I joined the group, and it worked out really well. And so I started writing fiction for the first time in my life. So that was one track that was going on. And I want to say that was probably started in 2005, somewhere around there. In 2007, I believe it was, a friend of mine and my wife's owns the audio rights to Winnie the Pooh. His his great uncle was J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, his family. He's an actor, a movie director, and he happens to own it. And he came down here to license the audio rights of Winnie the Pooh to Blackstone Audio, which was one of the, still is one of the leading audiobook companies in America, in the world. And he stayed with us while he was down here. And while he was meeting with Craig Black, who is the founder and owner of Blackstone, he told him about my wife and I and said, Craig, they probably have knowledge from New York that you corporations that none of your people have. So you probably can use what they've got. So Craig and Deborah and I went to lunch the next week. And after lunch, he said, you know, I don't exactly know what I'm going to do with you, but Christopher was right. I can use what you both have. So we got hired as consultants and we joined his first board of directors. And then Deborah fully retired. And about a year later, 2 years later, I went on staff as head of new business development, which I still do now. And I did that while I was somewhere in my mid-60s, I guess it was.
Wow. That's crazy. Awesome. I mean, it's awesome. It's awesome crazy.
Yeah, it's both.
Okay, Rick had never written fiction before, and yet he jumped right into writing a novel. How?
There are probably three types of writers, but there are two main types of writers, pantsers and plotters. Okay, plotters sit there and plot everything out beforehand, and they probably got like sticky notes on a wall somewhere with ideas and sequencing. And then pantsers are literally that. They are writers who fly by the seat of their pants and plan nothing. Well, I am a pantser. And so what happened was this story just appeared in my brain, which is how songs used to appear when I was writing songs. I can't explain the creative process other than they're there. And my job is to, either as a songwriter on a guitar or a piano, remember the song and, you know, capture it, or as a writer to sit at a keyboard at a computer and capture what I'm seeing playing out like a movie in my brain. And it was fiction, a fictional short story that started playing out. So I went with it.
How long did it take you to realize that you might be good at it?
Well, I've got to tell you that because I had done writing over the course of my life, but it was nonfiction and I had chapters in nonfiction anthologies on New Age music. And I actually had one in a book called More Kisses about your experience with your first kiss, you know, and stuff like that. And I wrote newspaper columns and magazine articles. I knew I had a talent. And in fact, when I was in college, I was at NYU in film school. And so I was writing scripts for my student films, if you will. And one of them came to the attention of the head of the NYU English department. And he arranged to get me an offer of a Fulbright scholarship in writing, which I turned down because it was in Australia. And I didn't want to leave the United States at that time for family reasons. And so I kind of knew I could write, but I didn't know if I could write fiction.
Turns out you can. Tell me what your approach to trying something new, especially like being in this new position in the publishing world. What is your approach? Like, what's your thought process? How do you get yourself through it?
I kind of go back to what I said earlier. It's an adventure. You know, I mean, I have always chased the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow my entire life. Sometimes for companies I was working for, and sometimes as an entrepreneur myself. But I always, always found that the chase was even more exciting than whether I found the pot of gold or not, because I've had disasters financially in my life, but I loved getting to that point. They just didn't work out. And then like with some of the recordings that I've done, you know, they worked out really well. So really the thought process with going to Blackstone was, wow, this is going to be cool. This is going to be fun. I'm going to get to use a lot of the knowledge I have built up. I'm going to get to be around a whole new set of people and in an industry that is similar to but different from the music industry. So the skills were translatable rather than being totally foreign. And I never, ever have let age be a factor. Whether I was young, I never thought I was too young for anything. And as a senior, I've never thought I was too old for anything. So it was just a natural, let's try something new here.
I just turned 40 last year. and I get intimidated. And sometimes I think part of my like imposter syndrome or like my fear of failure that keeps me growing at a slower pace than I'd like to in my mind is like kind of the apprehension of like,
let me cut in here for a minute and get to David's point. Sometimes as we get older, it feels like the world is changing faster than we can keep up. And sometimes we start to feel so overwhelmed and intimidated by those changes, so much so that we get stuck. We doubt ourselves and we tell ourselves stories like we're too old to start that new career or we're too old to be on TikTok, for example.
Do you ever have any of those feelings of doubt?
I think the key is that the words that you uttered have never come out of my mouth. I have never feared failure. Mm-hmm. I always felt that if you try something new, and this is both personally and professionally in business, if you try something new, there is always the chance that it will not succeed. That just comes with the territory of trying something new or change. And so if you fear that you're going to fail, it may paralyze you to never even try to start. And so it's never crossed my mind that I was ever going to fail at something. Everything I always went into, I thought was going to be a home run and was going to succeed. And when it didn't, my attitude was, okay, next. It wasn't, oh my God, what have I done or what happened? I would evaluate what happened and examine it to see if there's anything I could learn from failure. But it's never, ever bothered me, stopped me, or, you know, I write books now and I get good reviews and I get bad reviews. And some of the bad reviews written by trolls, it's pretty obvious. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. they're out there. But some of them are legitimate people who just don't bond with what I've written. That could stop me. I could say, oh my God. But I look at the bad reviews. Fortunately, there are way fewer of them. But I look at them and I go, what can I learn from them? And then I never read them again. I mean, mm-hmm. okay, I saw it once. I took away what I could that might be helpful. If there was nothing helpful, I go, damn, wish there was. And on to the next. I think the peeling of the onion, if you will, is just a belief in is life's exciting and sometimes there'll be failure and that's part of the territory.
Everything you are saying right now is stuff that I talk about a lot here, but it's stuff that like I have studied and worked on for years. I'm only sort of arriving in this understanding now in my 40s, and the fact that like you were just always sort of naturally of this belief that like I'm always saying like life is my learning journey and I'm just gathering information. And the fact that you like understood that for your like entire career is really, really admirable and incredible.
Life, not just career.
Right, your entire life.
Yeah. Well, I'll add another layer to it as well. And that is one of the things that I did, and this started right with my very first band that I created. And it went through my business career, not just my creative career, if you will. I always tried to surround myself with people who were better than me. Mm. I'm not saying I wasn't good. I was a good guitarist, good bass player. I could write songs. I was a good producer. You know, I mean, I was a really good executive, but I always tried to hire and surround myself with the best people I could. And as opposed to being afraid that they were going to take my job, if you will, I always knew they would elevate anything and everything I was involved in. So I just don't, the greatest fear I had was being able to provide a roof over, you know, my family's head and making sure I was earning enough to do that. That was really my greatest fear. What I did day to day was never fearful to me.
Yeah.
That was my next question. Were there any times where you felt a little bit of peril from that, where maybe you had done a couple of endeavors that didn't end up panning out and ever have a freak out moment?
I would have to say that I can only remember that happening twice in my life. And it happened in two record companies. It never happened in any entrepreneurial venture that I did by myself. But I overstayed my welcome in one record company. And when I say overstayed my welcome, I had a falling out with my boss. I thought he was wrong and I wouldn't do something that he asked me to do. And for 2 years, he basically ran the department without me, if you will. I worked on all my acts, but it was like I was persona non grata. I really should have quit when he asked me to do what I didn't think was ethical. But I didn't. And again, it came down to needing to feed my family. And then a second time, I was just in a situation where I did not enjoy the people I was working with. And I probably stayed there a little too long as well, but it was a shorter period. But, you know, each step of what I did took me to the next step. And maybe if I had left earlier, I wouldn't be who I am and where I am today. So I'm not going to look back and say woulda, shoulda, coulda. It's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe that. That's awesome.
I believe that too. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Oh, and by the way, I will also tell you, I do meditate. And my wife and I studied with a man named Dr. Joe Dispenza. I don't know if you're familiar with him. And we do manifesting. In fact, I manifested the success of my first novel. I've also done past life regression hypnosis. Love that too. And it's sort of like, I'm not very religious, but I'm very spiritual. And so I really believe in the quantum dimensions and I believe in the spiritual plane and I draw on that in my life.
Okay, let's get into that. But actually, before we get into that, I'd like to share with you another great little podcast I think you might enjoy.
What really happens to us when we die? There is growing evidence that suggests we never really die, but that our eternal souls take a journey from this earthly plane to the afterlife over and over again. Join me, Kristen Taylor, host of How I Made It Through, as I interview psychic mediums and those who have had near-death experiences, as they share insights about why we are here and what we can expect when we transition to the afterlife.
You started writing novels, and at 77, which was last year, you published your first one. It's called, please correct me if I say this wrong, Pinyon Scorpion and the Barbershop Detectives. It was a number one seller on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And then the second one in that same series was just released in February, which is called Murder in Hexford.
Right.
Tell us about this manifestation.
Well, the manifestation was that I started manifesting what success I would have with that first Scorpion book, which is kind of a classic whodunit set in 1910 England, featuring this new Scorpion, who's kind of this police inspector that's kind of a cross between Poirot and Holmes, but his own man in his own right. And I started manifesting well in advance. I manifested getting offers for the book. I manifested what would happen to the book. And what happened was that I'd love to say all, but not everything, but virtually everything came true. I got an agent. The agent got offers from multiple publishers for the book. When the book came out, it immediately won an award. It was named the Buzz Book of the Year by the Pacific Northwest Bookseller Association. Like you said, it went to number one in Amazon in five categories. It was a Barnes & Noble pick, an Amazon editor's pick. It was a Publisher's Weekly pick. It's gotten tremendous response and is doing very nicely. It's still selling. In fact, We just put together and are putting out for free a parent and teacher guide to it, because all of a sudden we're finding 15 and 16 year olds are finding this and going, wow, I love this. And that nothing pleases me more than that. So all of this I manifested and it happened. And the only thing that I manifested that did not happen is I saw myself on the Stephen Colbert show talking about it, and that did not happen.
Yet.
Exactly. You never know.
Okay. But so when you say manifest, what does that mean to you? What does that look like? What's the process?
Well, I kind of follow the process that the Dispenza lays out. It's not enough just to believe that it's going to happen. You have to live like it's already happening. So even before this book got sold, I was telling everybody it's going to be sold. I'm going to get multiple offers on it. My wife and I bought some things that we might not have bought if we didn't think that we'd have some extra income coming in. And I'm not crying poverty, but you know, I'm just saying, still in all, some extravagances, if you will. I was convinced. I just was living convinced that this event, what I was doing, already was happening in some other dimension, and it was going to translate to happening in our plane.
Wow.
And I hope this doesn't sound too woo-woo strange, but it is what I believe.
No, it's been around. Like, there's also like the Abraham Esther Hicks kind of stuff. You know, although Dispenza can sometimes be a controversial character. Yeah. He's very like well known in that field, you know. I'm 100% on board with it.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the idea of manifestation, and I don't know a lot about it, but I do know a little bit about it. A lot of it, I think, to me, or my understanding is, you know, not just like believing that you're already in it and you have it, and then that you know all these things are going to happen, and you're already, but also like there's so much like self-worth involved, like that you're worthy of the thing, that you're fully worthy of the thing, so that you're making those decisions based on like, no, I'm worthy, like you're stepping into your worth, I'm worthy of this thing, and so therefore I can make all these decisions and I can buy these extra things because I know that it's going to happen, because I know that I'm worthy that it's going to happen. Like there's so much self-worth around. Is that your understanding, or what do you think of that?
I think that is true for some people, but I would say that did not play in for me at all. I've never used the term self-worth or thought of it in terms of myself. No, the way I did the manifesting was basically mostly with the Dispenza meditations, and they would have manifestation elements to them. So while you're meditating, you're manifesting what you want to happen. You're drawing it. And then when you stop, you're living a life as though that's going to happen. And so there's no bout of doubt it, if you will. And so that's kind of what I did. I don't know. I've never thought I wasn't worthy of something. So maybe it's a false sense of pride, but or maybe pride's not the right word, but I've just never had questions about worthiness.
Were your parents, what was your relationship like with your parents? Because it seems like you've had this sort of feeling your whole life. Like you were always like this, like calm, collected, like this is my learning journey. I'm supposed to be here. And also if I fail, no worries. I don't have that. I'm very much like, it's a lot of work for me to step into my worth and to believe that.
Well, I'll tell you a little about my parents, because you're right. It absolutely started with my parents. One of the things both of my parents had was they were both right brain, left brain balanced. And I know that I inherited that because I couldn't be doing the creative stuff I'm doing and be equally good at being an executive and not have a left brain, right brain going on. My dad was an inventor. He owned, he had over 900 patents, I believe, but he was also an artist. He drew. He read a book every single night of his life, literally, and he was a scientist. He worked with Albert Einstein and other leading scientists.
Wow. I'm sorry. Can we just take a moment? Albert Einstein? I can't even... What? That is incredible. I'm speechless. Let's keep going.
My mother was a singer on the radio, and then later in life, she became a professor at NYU and then opened her own school for remedial learners. So they were really achievers, if you will, but also softened, if you will, by the arts, you know, in addition. And they introduced me early on to everything, to literature, to theater, to music, and they, when they introduced me to music, they introduced me to everything from opera to Django Reinhardt to the Weavers. It wasn't Pat Boone and Doris Day, who were, you know, like the hit singers of the era. And my parents, you know, when I told them I wanted to, you know, I heard rock and roll, and when I wanted to tell them I wanted to be a rock and roller, which I knew right away, they could have rebelled and said, well, no, that what kind of a life is that for, you know, you're from this learned family, you know, you're a bright kid. What do you want to do with rock? And they never said any of that. They just bought me guitars, bought me amps, supported me wholeheartedly, and told me what I told both of my sons. If you follow your passion and make it your vocation, it's not going to seem like as much work as it is fun.
Okay, so quick catch up. Rick has now published 2 books, and I'm guessing he's working on a third. He's also written a book about how to be a good leader in business, and he made a video game to accompany his mystery books, which you can find on Google and Apple.
I must say that I love technology, embraced it immediately. I studied programming just on my own, and I learned how to program both in DOS and machine language. I worked in the NYU computer lab back in the early 1960s when they were programming computers by plugging wires into transfer boards or whatever they're called. I programmed the first advertising database for BMG distribution. I brought fax machines into PolyGram when there were no faxes at the time. I just always embraced technology. I've loved it. The reason I embraced it is I love it. It just kind of comes naturally to me. I take advantage of it. And I am on TikTok.
See?
Yes. Hi again, it's me. Remember the book Tuesdays with Maury, the late 1990s memoir about the author interviewing his former teacher before he died of ALS? Yeah, you know the one. Well, Maury wrote his own book, which sat in a drawer for years after he died until his son and his wife rediscovered the book, edited it, and published it just last month. It's called The Wisdom of Maury, and it turns out that Blackstone, and particularly Rick, are the ones responsible for publishing it. It also happens that the advice Maury gives is very fitting for this show.
The Wisdom of Maury is Maury's own words, Maury's own thoughts, and it's his advice on how to age joyfully, gracefully, happily. And I think it's an absolutely phenomenal roadmap for anyone, especially seniors, but anyone almost at any age. It's just filled with great life advice, and you know that anyone at any age can use to make your life happier, more graceful, more enjoyable, and especially for seniors.
That's awesome. I can't wait to read it. I loved Tuesdays with Maury.
Well, I think it's the perfect companion, quite honestly.
As a person that's not so much a senior yet, but I talk with my mom a lot. And is that aging gracefully? Is that a complex thing? I don't know if I have a question completely formed, but...
But here I am. Let me help David out again. I think what he was trying to ask Rick was, does he struggle with getting older? What does that struggle look like? And what does he do about it?
I have friends who dwell on aging. You know, it's sort of like they're rushing the end of their life in a way because they can't kind of let go of, I'm getting older, I'm closer to the end than I am to the beginning. I other friends, which I'm more in the camp of, is aging's part of life, you know, and it's like I did certain things in my 30s, I did certain things in my 50s, now I'm doing certain things in my 70s, and hopefully I'll be doing things in my 90s and maybe my 100s. So it kind of varies person by person, but I do think there are a lot of people in our society who are concerned about aging. And, you know, we are a society that is more geared towards younger people than older people. So, I don't know that, ageism certainly does exist, but not universally.
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of go with what's not ageism.
Mm-hmm.
I want to chime in here because the last 2 episodes that I've put out were both very focused around this idea of ageism, especially this last one that just came out yesterday with Ashton Applewhite. She's the author of a book called This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. And we talk with her and with David from the last episode about like things like aging gracefully and how that is actually an essentially an ageist idea. First of all, if you're aging, you're succeeding, because what is the alternative? The alternative is that you're dead. and also the idea that like there's a different way to, there's a better way to age than other ways, that like the person who's running marathons in their 90s is somehow aging more successfully than the person who's in the wheelchair, and that's unfair. So anyway, just wanted to point that out just because it's so top of mind, because I've been having these conversations a lot lately, and I'll be having another interview with someone this afternoon about it too.
I'd like to respond to that, because I don't disagree with what you said, but where I do disagree is stress. That It's not a matter of whether someone that's running a marathon in their 90s is aging more gracefully than somebody who's doing nothing and sitting at home in their 70s. It's their stress level that, to me, is the aging gracefully part. Mm. Are you stressing about your age? Is it consuming you? Is it affecting your life that you can't do things because of your age? That, to me, is aging gracefully, when you get rid of all of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love
like
that.
Like staring at the hourglass, like the sand at the final minutes of the hourglass. You're like, are you going to play the game, or are you going to watch the sand go down?
Right.
That's a really, really good point. Thank you for pointing that out. I love that. And, you know, there's so much there too that we could talk about this for hours. But, you know, I think a lot of that stress too does come from like society telling us that we're supposed to be stressed about aging, which is really unfortunate. So it's like changing the narrative and talking more about this and having this conversation is really important. Anyway.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. What other tidbits of wisdom can you share with us as we're navigating, making changes and trying new things as we age? If anything, I feel like you're like a wealth of wisdom.
Well, there are certain things that I kind of believe, and some of them go and fit into nice, neat little sayings, and other things don't. But one of the ones that I want to tell you is, are you familiar with the show Grace and Frankie with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin? Mm-hmm. So I loved that show and watched it kind of religiously. And there was a character on the show named Mary Elizabeth. She was one of their friends. And now I grant you what I'm about to tell you was written by the writers of the show, but it was spoken by Mary Elizabeth in one of the, if not the last episodes of the show. And it just struck me as so apropos that I literally had to write it down because I wanted to remember it. And what Mary Elizabeth said was, you are always going to be disappointed if all you remember are your failures. So that's my job. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I just absolutely, and you know, in that regard, I never dwell on my failures. If I'm going to remember anything, I'm trying to remember my successes. I want to smile in memory, not frown or stress. Betty Friedan, great quote from Betty, aging is not lost youth, but a new stage of opportunity and strength. You know, I mean, it is. And like Michael Jordan said, I can accept failure. Everyone fails at something. What I can't accept is not trying.
Yes.
You know, and it's things like that. You know, it's sort of like when I was 77 and the first book came out, I could have said, I'm 77. Why would I still chase rainbows? You know, I'm too old. And if I did, nothing would have happened. So it's really mental attitude of saying to yourself, I'm not too old, and saying to yourself, something new is an adventure, not scary. And it, no matter what age you are, it's look, there are certain things you can't do. I can't fly a plane. I probably could if it was a private plane and I took lessons, but I'm not going to be an astronaut, okay? I know there are things I can't do, but I kind of look at it with the exception of those things that I can't do for some physical or reason like that. I kind of believe anything's fair game, so let me do the things that interest me that I want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for that.
Now the other thing is, you know, there are a lot of examples of of people who started things later in life. You may know this, but maybe all your listeners don't, viewers. But like Grandma Moses didn't start painting till she was 77 years old. Yep. Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes, started writing at 65. Colonel Sanders didn't franchise until he was in his 60s. And the name that I will throw from the past that you both may be too young to remember, but I don't know. Her name is Clara Peller. Clara Peller was an actress, and her first ever gig was at the age of 81.
Wow.
And her gig was, she was in a Wendy's commercial, and her big line was, "Where's the beef?"
Where's the beef?
And that was Clara Peller, and it was 81 when she got that gig, which was her first ever acting assignment.
Wow.
A guy named Harry Bernstein wrote a book called The Invisible Wall, which was a hit book, and it was his first hit book, and it was at age 96. So, you know, it's sort of like, you never know. Exactly.
You never know.
And into life. Like I say, you don't fear rejection, don't fear negativity. Just believe in yourself and plow on.
It's interesting you say that. I just, even the dwelling on the failures, I think like for me, what I realized later is that I dwelled on there was a lot of like fear of rejection and things like that. And I think that's why I didn't lean, even when you were talking about hanging around people that are always better than you. Like, I think I didn't do that for a while. I shied away, even though sometimes they invited me into the crowd. I still sometimes was like scared, and I decided that I can't live that way any longer. And I'm hoping that, like you said, like, it's not too late. Like, even though I do feel
it's not too late.
No, it's never. But, you know, in some ways, like I think every decade you fear like a midlife crisis, but then somebody that's older than you says, relax, you know?
When I left the music industry before I moved here to Ashland, mm-hmm. I decided to try my hand at acting.
Interesting.
When I was much younger, I had been in some summer stock theater, and I was in a TV movie. But you know, it was always just accidental, if you will. But when I left the music industry, I said, "Well, what's another adventure I could try?" So I had a professional headshot taken, and I went and auditioned for a talent agent in New York. And I ended up, unfortunately, getting gigs as extra, never a main gig. But I was an extra in Sex and the City and a Billy Baldwin pilot. And I was supposed to be in The Sopranos, but I was on vacation when they were taping it. So I never got, I wanted to be, I was going to be on the dais with Tony at a wedding. It would have been cool.
I thought you were going to say, but they wanted me to play the part in The Body Bag. So
cool.
Turned it down.
That's awesome. That's so awesome. We've done it. We've arrived. It's here that Rick reintroduces himself without using descriptors like writer or husband, because as we all know, we are not our successes, failures, or titles.
I'm Rick Bleiweiss. I'm 78 years old. I am a risk taker. I am a mentor. I am multifaceted. I am kind. I am caring. And I am spiritual.
Is there anything else that you're working on that you want to mention, and where can people find you?
Sure, absolutely. First of all, people can find me at rickbleiweiss.com, my website, or you can Google me and you'll find out a lot about me. And what am I working on? Well, let's see. In addition to the two Scorpion books, I have a short story featuring a contemporary character named Walker, not related to any other Walker of any other Western or anything like that. And it's there's a series of anthologies called Murder, Music, and Mystery. And they're mystery anthologies centered around the theme of a best-selling album. So the first one was Hotel California, and I have a story in there featuring Walker. The second one, which is coming out, I think this July, is Thriller, and I have a Walker story in that. There will be a Back in Black next year, and then a Bat Out of Hell the year after that. And so I'm doing those as well. I'm, like you said, I'm writing a book on caring leadership based on my years as an executive in two industries, and my experiences, peppered with behind the scenes anecdotes, you know, of well-known celebrities that illustrate some of the points that I raise. I'm writing the third Scorbian book. I'm writing my memoir, but I'm kind of, that's like the last in line of everything I'm working on. And then I started writing another book, and my agent said, I think this would be an even better screenplay than a book.
There we go.
Yeah.
And I said, finally in the movies.
I said, so, okay. And I'd never written a screenplay other than, like I said, for the student films, which, you know, that was, you know, decades ago and not quite the same. So I have now started writing a screenplay, and I'm about halfway through it. Lack of a better way to describe it, it's imagine the movie Home Alone meets the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Oh, great. Mm. Fun. I can't wait. I like Rick so much. And while I'm green with envy over his self-confidence, I'm also pink with gratitude that he came on the show to talk all about mindset and manifesting. He's got some great stories, and his writing ain't bad either. Side note, his character names and descriptions in his books and short stories are amazing. You'll find all of Rick's links in the show notes. If you like what we talk about on the show and you want more content more often or just a place to interact with me, go follow me on Instagram at MollyAtThisAge. Thank you to David Ben Perot for sound engineering and co-hosting, Dan Davin for the music, David Harper for the artwork. I Am This Age is produced by Jellyfish Industries. I'm your host, Molly Sider. We will catch you all next time.